Welcome, fellow plebs. My name is Sean, and this is
Tribunus Plebis.
And welcome back to the podcast, everybody. I appreciate you being here. And honestly, it's good to be back after getting my butt kicked by COVID for the past 3 weeks. The first thing I need to do is apologize for the delay between episodes. First, I got kind of, target fixated on the last episode to the detriment of everything else going on. And then I got COVID. And the COVID experience was pretty awful. It took me a week or so to get over the worst of it and another two to get back to some semblance of normal. Even this past week, I was having a hard time catching my breath just doing normal activities. Basically, it just beat the heck out of me and left me weak and miserable. So thank you to everybody who stuck around and waited for this episode, and welcome to anybody who's going to be a new listener as well. So today, I want to discuss some stuff about the recent railroad labor issues. Now, I do want to tell everyone that the actual negotiation, the nuts and bolts of it, they aren't what I want to talk about right now. What I'm going to focus on is more the response by the government, how the media talked about this, and how even the sympathetic people out there frame this fight. That said, I do want to run down a brief timeline of what went on, a real quick and dirty version just hitting the high points, and I'm going to do it mainly for, a little bit of a refresh and a bit of a background moving forward. And I'm going to try not to get stuck in too many rabbit holes because this did get kind of complicated. I'm going to explain what the railroad barons were unwilling to allow the workers to get from them, talk about how it went and why government ghouls will always side with the capitalist dorks who pay them and all of that. But due to being a little bit late on covering this, shamefully I must admit, due to the last episode and, COVID, the specifics of the grievances and the specific events along the way are not what I want to focus on. A lot of podcasts covered that stuff to some degree or another, and I'd recommend anything that came out of The Real News Network and Max Alvarez, where they discussed the dispute, and it was a bunch of episodes spread over the last half a year. So there's plenty to find, and they did an absolutely amazing job covering this issue. What I do want to focus on a little bit more than the negotiations themselves are basically 3 points. Who decided this and why, how the media covered this, and the general framing of it. Oh, and I'm probably also going to include a dash of criticism for how we talk about workers and labor disputes, negotiations, strikes, and facing the possibility of striking as well. And I want to do this for a few reasons. One is just to bump this entire saga in people's minds. I hate that we've already forgotten about it in the discourse. This was a massively important moment for American labor. Another reason is because what I'm going to talk about here regarding the railroads and the government and the media, and just how we, use even our own rhetoric, can very easily and effortlessly be applied to almost any story that you'll hear out there on the news. I do hope that as we talk about this and as the themes I will try to tease out become clear, that you'll be able to either apply some of it on something that is already in your memory, a current situation, or that you'll be able to apply them moving forward. Okay, so the basic quick and dirty timeline of the railroad negotiations with the union is basically what I'm about to tell you, I guess. And listen, one last warning here. I'm leaving out a lot of detail because this just isn't that episode. This will be super basic. The unions and the railroads have been negotiating for 3 years by the end of this thing and working without a contract for the last 2 of those years. That extra year was negotiations before the contract actually terminated. And negotiating, it might not be the best term to use here because the rail companies had stopped negotiating in good faith right in the beginning because they knew the inevitable outcome would favor their side. But over that time, these two sides did come close to a contract which was acceptable to all of the unions. They came close. And I guess we gotta admit that. And many of the unions agreed to ratify this contract, but the 4 biggest unions, representing over 50% of total workers, did not. And all of these rail unions, I believe it was 14 total, they have, the honoring of any other union strike written into their contracts. So if one strikes, they all strike. These unions negotiated raises, some concessions of work scheduling and benefits, and so on. But for some reason, the two sides just could not finalize the deal. And, you know, it's not really some reason. It's the reason was sick days, of all things. So at the end of the day, the railway barons, they just wouldn't concede on that one central point: sick days for their workers. And there was actually a reason that drove these robber barons to not want to provide sick days to their employees. That reason is something called precision scheduled railroading. It's a system that has been used to essentially use computers to more efficiently run the railroad. The payoff for the companies is fewer longer trains with fewer workers to run them and massive, massive profit margins. And hello there, everybody. As most of you probably know, this podcast takes a lot of time and effort to put together and, you know, to get out there for you good folks to listen to. And you, our listeners, can help us by liking and subscribing on YouTube. So please take a second to click those little buttons. It helps a ton. And if you are feeling just a little bit more generous and you enjoy what we do here at Tribunus Plebis Media, you can help us earn just a little bit of money for the large amount of labor that we put into this thing by signing up on our Buy Me a Coffee page, where you can make a one-time donation or sign up for a recurring monthly subscription. We do all of this for free, and we will never run ads in our works. But any contributions really do help keep the show going and improving. The page address is buymeacoffee.com/TribunusPlebis. And of course, all links will be in the show notes and descriptions wherever you are listening or watching. Thank you. And now, back to the episode. And listen, to be as generous as possible to the railroad dorks, better scheduling isn't necessarily a thing of evil. It's actually good for supply chains to be smooth and efficient, you know, up to a point. And see, this is one of those things. It's a tool. It's not good or bad or evil. It's just a way to make sure things move around the country a little bit better. But capitalist greed, the demanding of more and more profits to be funneled to the loser shareholders and C-suite dorks, resulted in them cutting costs, aka firing workers and making their lives as hellish as possible for those who remained. So more efficiency isn't bad in and of itself, but it is bad when it starts to harm human beings. Precision scheduling is a tool that becomes bad when it becomes weaponized against workers and used as an almost literal chain to keep people on the job and enslaved to an insane 24/7, 365 on-call job. Beyond that, the major drawback of PSR is less safe trains, dangerous to the public, less repair time, fewer opportunities for tracks and bridges and trestles and cars to be maintained. The drawback for workers is that there are far fewer workers. The railroads have been shedding workers for years. Over the past 20 years, they've cut something like 50% of their workforce. Mile-long trains that were being run and worked by 5 employees are now 2 or 3 miles long and being operated by only 2 people. Not only is this less safe in pretty much every possible sense, it actually clogs the tracks because the trains are now too long to pull off into sidings and allow other trains to go by like they used to. And if a train does break down, workers might have to walk up to 2 miles to get where the problem is, fix it if they're lucky, and walk back to their engines and get moving again. This is a problem for scheduling on a one-track railroad because the train is clogging the tracks, but it's also a massive issue if it breaks and blocks a major intersection with cars. This same lack of workers has also led to the conditions that drove the biggest disagreement between labor and capital in this whole situation. Like I said, sick days and time off, but especially the sick days. Trains are required to have 2 people on them for safety. Redundancy, I guess you could say. And remember, they used to have 5 people. This number has been constantly driven down by the needs of the PSR system to cut costs, build bigger trains, fire workers, and work employees until they are ground into nothing. And this, by the way, has another profound effect on the entire rail industry. New workers don't want to deal with all of this nonsense. The lack of time off, the lack of family time, the lack of health care, and so on. And so the railroad can't replace workers who retire or break under the pressure and quit. This is a situation very similar to trucking, by the way, which is where I work. It just isn't worth it if you're just starting out. And now, just 2 weeks after Biden the scab ordered railroad workers back to work on a bad contract which the workers rejected, two of the big railroads have already begun petitioning the Federal Railroad Administration to have just one person working on these trains, which will result in even fewer employees, which will put even more pressure on remaining workers and push the rail companies to be even more harsh with time off requests. Because here's the thing about cutting costs. At some point, you just can't do it anymore with a lot of stuff, rent, fuel, and other fixed costs that are out of a company's control, or at least say aren't fully within the company's control. And once you hit that point, the only way to cut costs is to attack labor. And that's what's happening here. The sickness just continues to metastasize. So now the railroad has fired so many workers and cut back so much that it's nearly impossible to take a day off because there just aren't enough employees to cover for you. Plus, to take a sick day, you are actually punished for it in ways that would be considered more than extreme in any other profession in this country. So they had this new contract 90%+ negotiated, but the big hang-up that remained was almost unbelievably, again, these few sick days. These railroad baron dorks actually refused to allow their workers to take sick days. And I know I've said sick days like 12 times already, but holy crap, right? What in the hell is this world? Warren Buffett, billionaire owner of the BNSF Railroad, one of the richest people on the planet, and well-known bastard with good PR, couldn't stomach the thought of allowing some of the hardest working people in this country to simply stay home and take time to visit a doctor when they're sick or vomiting or suffering from diarrhea. CEOs of the five biggest rail companies were paid collectively over $200 million as they forced their employees to work while they were sick, forced their workers back onto trains even during the worst COVID times as they were sick with COVID. And now I drive an 18-wheeler for a job, and I just had COVID. And let me tell you something, you didn't want me behind the wheel of a 70-foot-long, 20-ton missile while I was suffering because it would have been anything but safe. And I can't imagine wanting a train conductor suffering through that and being in command of a 2-mile-long freight train. I don't have the foggiest idea of what those things weigh, but I've seen what they look like when they derail. Now imagine that 20 of those cars had toxic materials and gases on board and they burst open. It would be an absolute disaster. The CEOs of these companies were paid over $200 million over the past 3 years, and over the past 10 or so, those same railroads have spent over $100 billion on stock buybacks to enrich themselves and their capitalist dork buddies who make up their boards of directors and major shareholders, all while crying about some workers wanting sick days. In a letter to shareholders earlier in 2022, Buffett wrote this about BNSF. He said, quote, "Your railroad had record earnings of $6 billion in 2021. Here it should be noted we are talking about the old-fashioned sort of earnings that we favor, a figure calculated after interest, taxes, depreciation, amortization, and all forms of compensation," end quote. And here's Jennifer Hammond, CFO of Union Pacific, in an October of last year earnings call to the railroad investors, where she notes that shareholders have received $7.9 billion in dividends and share repurchases, and that they will buy back an additional $6.5 billion over 2023.
Year to date, shareholders have received $7.9 billion through dividends and share repurchases. This level of cash returns demonstrates our firm commitment to rewarding shareholders with strong returns. Related to share repurchases, we now expect to buy back roughly $6.5 billion in 2022.
Yeah, they literally just tell us this stuff in their quarterly reports, but most of us just don't listen. Now, even worse than all of that is what I'm going to read next. This paragraph from a report put out by the Presidential Emergency Board, more on them a little bit later, a board which President Biden put together to help negotiate a contract and avoid a lockout or strike pretty much sums up the entirety of why our current economic system and our political and social culture is so broken right now. Quote, "The carriers maintain that capital investment and risk are the reasons for profits, not any contributions by labor. The carriers further argue that there is no correlation historically between high profits and higher compensation, either in the freight rail industry or more generally. To the contrary, one of the carriers' experts maintained that the most profitable companies are not those whose compensation is the highest. The carriers assert that since employees have been fairly and adequately paid for their efforts and do not share in the downside risks if the operations are less profitable, then they have no claim to share in the upside either." End quote. The carriers maintain that the record profits which they are currently earning are not related at all to any contributions from their workers. How absurd is that? They also said that workers do not share in the downside risks if the operations are less profitable, which is utter nonsense. Workers get fired. That's extreme risk. Extreme risk. Who are these people saying this stuff? The profits have nothing to do with workers? That is insane. That workers don't suffer when the company suffers and they get fired? That, it's just absurd. And this isn't even like the sicko CEOs who are writing this. It's the supposedly independent presidential emergency board. And I guess I should explain the board here real quick and continue with the timeline. So they negotiated for 2 years. They got close but couldn't solve it. What then? Well, they went through a bunch of stuff. But at the end, I guess the first thing to know is that the railroads are not covered by the National Labor Relations Act like most other workers. It's actually covered by the Railway Labor Act, which was created and implemented after the Great Rail Strike of 1922, which shut down a huge chunk of the economy. That 1922 strike scared those in charge so badly that they did their level best to never, ever let rail workers ever have any real power ever again. A threat and a promise which exists right to this very day, as we will see, and they follow through on it every time. Basically, what this act did was, when a negotiation had run its course and a lockout or strike seemed imminent, it would first demand a couple of cooling off periods and then allow the President of the United States to create this emergency board if the two sides could not agree after these cooling off periods. The board would have authority to suggest a compromise solution, and then even if that solution was voted down, the President and Congress could simply order workers and companies to take a certain deal. Basically force them back to work on a bad contract. And this was what happened in this past December. After the negotiation stalemated, the emergency board created a contract which the majority of workers again rejected. And then the federal government stepped in and said, no, too bad, and it forced them to take a bad deal and to keep going back to work. There was a flaccid attempt in Congress to include 7 sick days in this, you know, forced contract, but the Senate, a group of government workers who have the privilege of unlimited amounts of paid sick days and high wages and awesome health care, they rejected the idea and voted against workers having sick days. All of that, 3 years negotiating, 2 years without a contract, the unions ready and willing to strike, and the key hang-up being something as normal and non-radical as just having sick days. And the President of the United States, Joe Biden the scab, he just stepped up and kicked the American rail workers right in the teeth. And that's the, you know, the dirty version of what happened. Just the high points and a lot passed over and maybe some of it overexplained. If anyone's interested, let me know. I'll record a short episode that is more focused on the details of the past 6 months or so, and maybe some more technical stuff on how it all got to this point, if anybody's interested, but I'll push on here in lieu of that. Okay, so the first of the three discussion points I wanted to hit was who forced this solution and why, which is maybe kind of obvious from what I've just talked about so far, but I want to rant a bit, so bear with me. The federal government, like we talked about in the class, labor, and solidarity episode a few weeks ago, is completely captured by capital. Political parties are funded by wealthy individuals and corporate donors. Individual political campaigns are funded by the wealthy goobers and the corporate dorks. Super PACs, well-funded think tanks and NGOs, and direct payouts from corporations, wealth funds, philanthropy, and, you know, wealthy individuals directly. Well, I was going to say they influence, but they don't really influence. They actually write policy, laws, and rules, and simply force their puppet politicians to pass them under threat of taking away their money. And also, they influence these things less directly, of course. Joe Biden, the scab, ran for president claiming to be the most pro-labor president of all time. And then he chopped the legs out of what would have been the most powerful labor fight in many years. He just absolutely destroyed the core strength of unions with one single move, and then smiled into the camera and said that he was pro-worker. Biden is really no better than Trump at this point, right? Both are fully bought and paid for by moneyed interests. The Big Five Class 1 railroads just own D.C. They own it outright with bribes, and they own it just with their threat to the stocks of those in charge. And whoever they don't directly own are too weak-kneed to do anything about it, if any of those types even exist out there at this point. Maybe Bernie Sanders was like the only decent politician who voted against this, and, you know, who has vocally supported workers here, but nobody else. Sure, some ghouls like Marco Rubio gave lip service to being pro-worker, but they didn't actually mean it, and we need to understand that. Hell, the Republicans themselves voted to force these same workers into a contract a few months earlier. They're all liars. Screw them all. Again, they could not even come together to vote to let railroad workers call out from work when they're vomiting and delirious without risking discipline and firing. And, you know, actually, now that I said the word discipline, that's what this entire situation was. It was a disciplining of workers by ownership, a disciplining of labor by capital, a bougie spanking of the proletariat. The oligarchs just wanted the workers of this country to know who was in charge, and the government rubber-stamped that declaration both metaphorically and quite literally. And now, before I get to my last 2 points, I do want to throw something else here to break up point 1 and 2. And that's a bit of criticism for how some of us on our side, those who support workers, how we talked about those workers either thinking about striking or even when they have struck. Now, this is just a personal opinion. I'm not sure how many people are going to agree with me here. But too often, I see people demanding a strike at the drop of a hat. They post things like, "All I want for Christmas is a railroad strike," which they post from their work-at-home desk job. Now, I'm not meaning to dump on folks working from home, but while I haven't personally been on a strike, I've talked to and been directly around people who have, and I've even spent some time with some people while they were actually on strike. And it is not easy. It's not fun, and it's not something that these people entered into lightly or that they found too exciting. It just feels a little weird, like being this excited about telling people to take such a monumental and potentially devastating step. I know the theory, and I understand why people are so enthused, but at the end of the day, these are still human beings who are going to suffer. Strikes can be hell. Stress, financial issues, health issues, insurance issues, emotional issues, and so on. Not getting paid for weeks is terrible. Being demonized for weeks by outsiders is terrible. Holding the line is hard as hell. I've also seen people demand workers should stay on strike even after they've negotiated a contract and gone back to work after, you know, like 2 months of striking. Now, personally, I try not to talk about, you know, a negotiated contract and strike like that. If the workers got what they could and decided to take it, I'm happy. I just don't feel comfortable, you know, cashing my full check with overtime and driving home and telling people that they should have held out longer for something that maybe they, you know, maybe it just wasn't that important to the strikers. The strikers who had real life issues and had to make hard choices. I do think it's okay to have an opinion on someone else's contract and benefits and whatnot. I just think that we should be a little more understanding of the fact that we, you know, that we live in a world and we all are suffering under this system and, you know, short of actual harm, we should have a little more empathy for how everybody deals with what's going on out there, even in labor disputes. So, all right, I'll get off my little high horse here and hit point two, how the media talked about this. And, you know, I'm looking at my notes here, and I guess point three was going to be a general framing discussion, but I think I'm just going to work that in here as well. So two and three are now just point two. So the first thing I'd want to do to sort of illustrate what I'm going to talk about is have you Google something like railroad labor contract or railroad union, NBC or CNN or Fox or, you know, potential railroad strike, something like that, and look at the headlines. I bet most of them contain words like strike averted or strike halted, strike avoided, or, you know, something along those lines. Always about a strike. Always this purposefully one-sided framing and language. Scroll through a couple pages of results, Google it various ways, and tell me how many times you see a headline or story that contains the word lockout. Because a lockout, which is when the company shuts the doors and prevents workers from working, it was a very real possibility in this whole thing, but we never hear about it outside of a few sources. Every single article was about a worker strike. We might look and see this and ask the question, why? Well, it's because the media has a certain narrative, a certain lean in favor of a certain group of people who pay all of their bills. And I'll give you a hint. It isn't the people who work at railroads. It's the people who own the railroads. Okay, I guess that was more than a hint. Yes, all of these articles, all of these news talking heads, all of these politicians, they talked about strikes and they talked about them in the most slanted way possible. They would have a train CEO on and ask them, will the workers strike and destroy the economy?
President Biden warning, if that happened, it would devastate the economy if we had a strike like that. So joining me now to talk about this and a lot more is Bank of America's Brian Moynihan, chairman and CEO, one of the biggest banks in the world.
They would talk to rail workers and ask, are you really going to shut down the trains just before Christmas and ruin the holidays?
Do you believe a strike is worth it if it cripples the U.S. economy and costs up to $2 billion a day?
More than $2 billion per day.
Is it worth it?
And on top of all of that, the holidays are right around the corner.
It's a little less than a month right before Christmas here.
Especially right before the holidays.
They would ask union reps why they thought that destroying the economy was worth it just for sick days.
I'm not setting aside the concerns of your members, but are you and your members willing to stop the rails, in effect, and accept those costs to the U.S. economy?
And you notice the framing of this question, right? They're posing the hundreds of thousands of rail workers as the people who would be responsible for destroying the economy, ruining Christmas, and keeping food from American tables. But did they ever ask the five CEOs of these railroads why they'd be willing to destroy the economy rather than give workers a few sick days? Did they ever talk to James Fritz, CEO of Union Pacific, who was paid $14.5 million and can call out sick anytime he wants while earning about 162 times as much as the median Union Pacific employee? Did they ever ask him why he was willing to destroy Christmas rather than allow feverish, vomiting workers to take a day off and recuperate and see a doctor? Did they? No. No, sir. Couldn't do that. And even as the contract negotiations hit critical dates and the threat of a lockout or strike loomed, the media would say things like how this contract had a record raise in it, which is a lie because these workers hadn't had a raise in 3 years, and this new contract was an attempt to make up some of that difference. But nobody adds that to the story. Nobody mentions that the railroad sat back, refused to budge, and relied on the government doing what it was supposed to do and bailing them out. Well, actually, not nobody. A few podcasts did, a few YouTube shows, but they were preaching to the choir. The truth is, five people, the CEOs of the big railroads, held the keys to solving this literally years ago. But they were too busy artificially inflating their damn stocks with buybacks, firing workers, putting the entire country in danger due to understaffing, poor maintenance, and psychopathic scheduling, and abusing workers, to do something as humane and basic as allow sick people to heal. Five people could have ended this, yet the media focused on the hundreds of thousands who lacked any real power and blamed them instead. And we know why. Those five powerful people keep CNN's lights on and they keep Joe Biden's pockets lined with thick stacks of greenbacks, Jack. None of this is a secret. This was all out there in the open. You heard Hammond on that earnings call. But not only does capital have control of the government and media, it also has control of the cultural zeitgeist, and it has a hold so powerful that most of us hear a so-called journalist ask a locomotive repairman making $80,000 a year or something, whether fighting for the ability to not work while they are uncontrollably defecating water and physically decimated and, not get fired for it. Is that worth destroying the economy for? And then we sit there in front of our TVs and think, yeah, man, is it worth it? We just go with it rather than open our eyes a bit and say, wait a second. Why in the world is this anchor not asking the CEO of this guy's company why they refuse to let the sick worker just stay at home and heal? It doesn't even enter our heads because we've been fully subsumed into this, absolute insanity that we call this country. We blame a boilermaker for wanting a few sick days and accuse them of trying to destroy the country instead of just like punching that dork CEO who refuses to give our fellow workers those sick days right in the face. And I'm not recommending you punch a CEO right in the face that was just, in a video game. But really consider what I'm trying to say here. Please try to consider it. It's a deeply sick state of affairs that we blame each other and don't even see where the real power, evil, and problem lies. It's not the guy with the sledgehammer, I will tell you that much. The corporate dorks and government goons and media mouthpieces want to frame this as a labor problem rather than as an evil robber baron problem, and that is just nonsense, and we should all see it at this point. The final argument that you'll hear, and this will be repeating myself a bit after discussing the blaming of workers for the situation, but it's, that a strike or lockout would be harmful for the economy. And it certainly would. It would cause issues all over the place. It would inconvenience people and raise prices for things and just be generally annoying and awful. I can't deny that. But it's really important to make it really clear that this is exactly the point of a strike. It's the point of a lockout as well. With a strike like this, it would have been the exact purpose of the event, to cause headaches and show people just how important the workers are and to put pressure on the companies to give sick days to its workers. Now, this is worth avoiding, by the way. Nobody wants a strike like this, but it was needed in this case according to the workers themselves. And some others say, well, the government gave them a couple of concessions in the contract, which they forced the workers to take. And I'm going to tell you, it doesn't matter. That's not the point. Even if the government had given the workers everything that they wanted and forced them back to work, it was still an attack on labor power, an attack on the actual agency of the American working class. As hard as a strike can be, this is the big hammer that workers can wield. It's the nuclear option, to borrow a phrase. Joe Biden, the scab, who has repeatedly called himself the most pro-labor president in history, is now a certified strikebreaker. The U.S. Congress are strikebreakers. They essentially disarmed and defanged the entirety of the railroad workforce and the working class in a broader sense. They are in many ways scabs, the lowest form of humanity. The end result of this entire situation, the abuse of the Railroad Labor Act, the abuse of the Emergency Board, the kneecapping of labor power, and the unbridled support of the railroad corporations over human beings, the choice to side with capital over labor, the choice to put profits over people in a single, morally disgusting act, it was all to punish and discipline American workers at large. The powers that be simply cannot allow workers to understand their own strength when they operate as a group. Even beyond that, the no sick days policy is nothing short of a form of dictatorial control of workers' bodies, almost a literal fettering of these proletarian humans to their masters' machines of production. Yes, this was a battle between capital and labor, but it was also a battle between cruelty and decency. The federal government tipped the scales for railroads and capital at large while fundamentally harming the American working class. Basically, the supposed referees corrupted the game and gave the win to cruelty and indecency. No workers should suffer with no sick days. No workers should be on call 24/7 with no real ability to take time off, even for planned vacations. No workers should suffer under this sort of yoke, and no workers should ever have their dignity assaulted in this way. Yes, this round was lost, but the battle will continue into perpetuity because our system is, at its heart, a system which pits the owners against the workers in a timeless war. Wages, benefits, time off, sick days, and safety are just some of the battlegrounds, and they are the ones most stories like this tend to focus on. But there are other battles as well, ones that are just as important, if not even more so. We fight for respect, we fight for dignity, we fight for quality of life. The war is fought for justice and equity and our very humanity. Tribunus Plebeius stands with those railroad workers just as it stands with all workers, with a raised fist, solidarity, and with the lyrics of a famous labor song which forms a question on our lips. Which side are you on? And that, my friends, is the end of the episode. I hope you liked it. Again, sorry for the wait. I was really sick. But other than that, yeah, I mean, I guess that's it. I mean, we have a Buy Me a Coffee page, buymeacoffee.com/TribunusPlebeius. Links are in the description. You can give monthly, which some of you have very generously done. That's awesome. We have a YouTube page. I don't have a custom link yet, but you can find all those links in the description. Please subscribe, like, comment, everything. That all really helps on the YouTube end. I think that's it for today. Thank you, everybody. I love you.